From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence focuses on priorities for police reform and addressing what brings tens of thousands of Michiganders to protest in the street.
We say a pledge of allegiance to this country. We say one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Also, as schools tentatively move toward reopening this fall, how will they talk to students about the summer's protests?
By not talking directly about race, we have reduced ourselves to talking and using dog whistles and coded language to talk about race.
And the head of a performing arts center talks about the work of carrying equity forward across the year.
We are currently in a moment, and moments don't last.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we speak with a longtime educator about how racism and Black history is taught in Michigan schools.
The curriculum, of course, is very much written to, and forgive the term, to whitewash some of the more horrific parts of American history.
But before we hear those stories, the United States has not experienced a Juneteenth like this one in quite some time. The national discussion of equity has been completely blown open by the protests touched off by the death of George Floyd and fed by generations of disparate treatment of people of color. Now we're joined by Representative Brenda Lawrence, Congresswoman representing Michigan's 14th District, to talk about the times and the work of the House in this moment. Congresswoman Lawrence, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's truly a pleasure to be with you today and to hear your strong voice and to be able to talk with you today.
We have so much we want to ask you about, but let's start with the issues dominating the streets. What have your thoughts been over the past couple of weeks as people have been marching all over Michigan and indeed all over the world to bring attention to police brutality against Black people?
So I'm of the age that I was a child during the civil rights movement and not quite able to participate because I was a child, but watched my grandmother cry, who was a Southern woman who migrated from the South and knew clearly the Jim Crow laws and what was being fought for. To hear in 2020 to be in the middle of this continuous fight and questioning where have we moved forward as a country, and to now see just the amazing diversity of voices, as heartbroken as I am that we're having this hard discussion with the country that I love, I'm hopeful because of the diversity of voices in every state in the United States of America protesting, using their constitutional right to say, as an American who believe in a democracy, believe in values and laws and inclusive respect for all, that this is unacceptable in America, and they're fighting for the rights of Black people in America. It is so hopeful. And now that we're at the point where we're trying to pass meaningful laws and policies, we do have two bills that are rising through our democratic process through the House and through the Senate. I am very hopeful that we will come together to produce a bill to go to the president's desk, but it cannot be one of just ceremony. It has to have transformational change and racism in regards to policing in this country.
You know, to that end, there's quite a lot in the House bill. Perhaps the measure that's getting the most attention in the Senate reform package would limit the use of chokeholds. What reforms do you think are most pertinent right now?
I feel strongly the chokeholds should be banned. You know, one point that a lot of people have missed in the middle of that horrific video of a police officer taking the life of a human being, that police officer was training. I want you to just think a moment about that. He was training two new officers on how to police. So it's a culture that's within the police departments around this country that it is okay, that that type of unnecessary force, that type of total disrespect and regard for Black men is taught for generation after generation of police officers. So there are some things that are very strong for me. That officer also had a long list of allegations and complaints about him with unnecessary force. Those type of databases that would reflect those type of officers who should be pulled out, retrained, or reformed, and if not, fired, is something that I feel is very, very important, that we actually establish a national roster of these bad players. I'm a former mayor, so I firmly believe and support in a professional, well-trained, compassionate police department. Police are there when we are at our most vulnerable, when we call 911 to come and to protect us, to rescue us, not to beat us, not to find ways to incarcerate us.
When you took office, you took up the baton from Congressman Conyers and have continued his practice of introducing a bill every session to explore reparations. Do you think that proposal will be heard differently in the coming year?
Yes, because what's being realized is that there are layers and layers of racism that African Americans in this country have had to survive through, had to fight through, had to just be subjected to. And that is why the question of reparations is so important. And, you know, some people have such a negative, derogatory response to reparations. It happened in Germany. They do not allow any statues in Germany of any of the Nazi leaders. Why? Because through the conversation of reparation, acknowledging what they did was wrong, why would they subject the citizens to glorifying someone who purposely wanted you imprisoned and killed and diminish you as a human being? We have allowed that in the United States. So reparations is a time, first of all, for our country to stop and say what we did was wrong. And if we get nothing else but an apology from the United States of America, no one's asking for 40 acres and a mule. But when you look at the justice system, the rate that African Americans are in prison, when you look at the educational outcomes of large minority African American communities, obviously something needs to happen in America.
Part of our conversation in Michigan dealing with our own history involves Lewis Cass. He was a former governor and senator of the state whose name is plastered all over streets and schools and buildings. And there's also a statue of him at the U.S. Capitol. This is a man who was a slave owner and who was responsible for policies that just devastated Native people. He opposed abolition. Do you think his statue at the Capitol should come down?
Yes. Because when you glorify and make a statue of a person, you are validating his life, his mission, his accomplishment. So are we doing that? And just like we renamed Cobo Hall, we have the Black Caucus, which I'm a member of. We have a concerted effort along with the support of Nancy Pelosi, thank goodness, to remove these statues from that insult to injury. We named one of the sections of our Capitol Emancipation Hall. And in that hall, we have some racist slave owners statue erected in there, and they were absolutely be removed from there.
I just have one more question for you. We're settling into this time of year in which conventional wisdom says it's really hard to get meaningful legislation passed. And yet we know that Michigan's institutions, especially public schools, but really everything down to the community level, are facing so many serious cash problems because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you predict some agreements can be reached to make additional aid packages available for schools or for other kinds of COVID recovery?
There has been in this last a lifetime, I've been a Democrat, but I can tell you being in Congress in this year has made me proud to be a Democrat even more. The fact that we passed a bill that would literally fill the gaps that were created in those financial budgets and resources that our state, our counties, and our cities and municipalities have had to absorb is one that we passed and we sent to the Senate. It is in Mitch McConnell's graveyard. And these cities are not Democrat or Republican. They are our citizens of the United States. It's something a lot of people don't know. I was a mayor for 14 years. Cities must balance their budget. So they are already cutting funding from their budgets based on the fact that they are anticipating without any help, the state will be cutting money. So we have done our work and hopefully the Senate will take it up.
Congresswoman Lawrence, we know you've got to go, but thank you for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This is, if I could just leave with this, this is a time that we really, really need to understand that we say a pledge of allegiance to this country. We say one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And as you see these protests and you see all that is happening, it is because we truly believe that we're one nation. So injustice to one, as Martin Luther King said, is injustice to all. We believe that justice should be for all.
Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence represents Michigan's 14th District. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
After the break, we're going to touch base with a Black cultural arts center in Detroit that's finding ways to survive as the economy crumbles, but the mission is more important than ever.
The conversations are just beginning. The reality is you can't solve a 400-year-old problem in 2 or 3 weeks.
They also have a really great online program planned for this Father's Day on Sunday. Hang on, we'll tell you all about it. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Carr Center, a Detroit staple ever since its beginnings as the Arts League of Michigan in 1991, has been exploring online programming with several digital events a week ever since the COVID-19 shutdown began. And the Performing Arts Center is returning into action this Father's Day with Come Sunday. It's a virtual concert with jazz virtuoso Rodney Whitaker, his children, and trombonist Mike Dees. We're speaking today with President and Chief Executive Officer Oliver Ragsdale Jr. about this and several other things the Carr Center is working on for the summer. Oliver Ragsdale, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, April, how you doing?
Just sitting upright seems like a big victory today, so I'm going to call it good.
It's a victory every day.
The Carr Center has been around, as we said, for decades, but there may be some folks newer to the city who don't know as much about its mission and history. Could you give us the thumbnail sketch?
Well, the Arts League of Michigan, which is our nonprofit parent, if you will, started in 1991 as an organization set up as a cooperative for African-American arts organizations. And over the years, it evolved from an organization that was more or less a cooperative to one that was very focused on community programming and bringing the best and greatest African-American artists into Detroit while at the same time raising and developing the next generation of African-American artists.
We would be remiss if we didn't note its role in making the area of Harmony Park, you know, so much of the vibrant place that we see today.
Well, we were there for 9 years, and it was a vibrant spot. A lot of great things happened in the Harmony Club building, and that was the evolution to the name The Carr Center. That was the space that we were in. I'm happy that we are now in the Cultural Center, and the work that we're able to do with our partners at Midtown has been and is about to be even greater than what we've done in the past 30 years.
Let's maybe take Sunday's program as something of a case study. This is a virtual concert, and it's called Come Sunday, featuring bass player, Michigan State University music professor, and father, Rodney Whitaker, and some of his extremely talented family. His kids are going to be part of the program as well.
Correct.
And also guest trombonist Mike Deese is on the program. This really feels like an intersection between artists who are vital and very visible in the community and both have a more global portfolio.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's sort of a role and a niche that the Carr Center has taken. Rodney, he's also our resident artist in jazz at the Carr Center. And we've been partners together for probably close to 20 years. We're doing jazz education programs, doing concert series. And now Rodney serves as artistic director of our young professional fellowship program, The Gathering Orchestra.
You know, translating the experiences that people may have had at the Carr Center's physical plant into this virtual environment, has that changed at all during the pandemic?
You know, it's really interesting. 6 months ago, we were beginning to think about online programming as it related to the renovation and development of our new spaces in the Cultural Center in the Park Shelton. And what COVID and the pandemic did was accelerate that thinking. Once all of our performances and exhibitions were canceled, our staff focused on what the new would be. That's what we call it. We don't think that there's a thing called the new normal that's about to happen. We just call it the new. Mm-hmm. And that thinking and those weekly and biweekly meetings that we would have led us to really developing this virtual concept and able to roll it out beginning this week.
Can you say more about what you mean when you say that we should not think of this as a new normal, but just as the new?
Well, you know, we don't know what it's going to be on the other side. For those of us who are heavily in the performing arts world, we really don't know. You know, there are some significant challenges of how we're going to see theater in the near-term future, for sure, how we're going to see a symphony orchestra. And so what we tried to think about was, what would our new be during coming out of the pandemic? You know, we've decided and have developed a program around what we call duos and duets, because that's going to be the size of presentation that you're going to be able to do in the performing arts in the short term.
Right.
And so we're preparing to roll out a new program in September, October, when our new performing arts studio is completed. But that studio now will be fully equipped for broadcast. So all of our presentations will have the ability to be in person, live, and live streamed, and we'll be archiving the work for future viewing.
One has to hope that this may yield some possibilities and benefits even beyond the pandemic, just in terms of people who consider themselves Detroit-affiliated and might want to touch base with what you're doing.
You know, there's no doubt about it. We have a tremendous artistic team led by Terry Lynn Carrington as our artistic director. We're spending a lot of time and conversations thinking about what could these new duos be. And Terry talks about it in terms of what would be a traditional duo or duet, piano and violin, singer and a piano. But also we're thinking about, how do you mash dance and drums? How do you put together what we call duo plus one, which could be a third person who's projected on a screen?
Oliver, you have long experience in nonprofit arts administration. Do you worry about the economics for forms like, say, large-scale jazz ensembles or other kinds of performing arts that thrive on their size and the fullness of their sound or their experience?
The first thing I worry about is the art. What is the implications of that? Our largest ensemble is the Gathering Orchestra, which is an 18-piece big band. How do we bring them back together for performance? How do we provide the training opportunities? That's first and foremost. For us, earned income, good or bad, wasn't a big driver for the organization. The ability that we have to be able to start up quickly in the fall, as soon as our space is done, with a capacity that could be 25 or 40%. It was a number that was below what the cost of the event was going to be anyway. So for us, I'm not concerned. If I'm Broadway, if I'm a symphony orchestra, if I'm a large dance company, I think that there are challenges both on the stage and off the stage in the audience.
How do you see your performing arts spaces working in the fall when, as you say, when you're ready to open the doors again?
Well, as I said, we're going to start with the duos and duets. That will be the performers on one side, and we'll have audiences of 25 to 50 in the space. Fortunately, in our new space, we are renovating the former ballroom in the Park Shelton when it was a hotel. So it's a large open space and it doesn't have permanent seating and it doesn't have a stage. So it gives us tremendous, tremendous flexibility.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Oliver Ragsdale, president and CEO of the Carr Center, a hub for performing arts in Detroit. What else is on the Carr Center's agenda for the summer? I'm sure a lot of people were curious to know if academies for young people would still be held.
Absolutely. Starting on June the 29th, we are doing our annual summer dance intensive with Debbie Allen, but we're doing it virtually this year. Enrollment is going on until next week, the beginning of next week. And for 3 weeks, students will have the opportunity to study with Debbie and her incredible team of artist teachers from LA. Our students in Detroit will be studying at home 6 days a week for 5 hours a day. They'll be doing all of the things, hip hop, tap, ballet. There's a music theater class for 2 weeks that Debbie will be teaching herself. We also have a program that we are currently engaged in partnership with the College of Creative Studies, Mosaic Youth Theater, and Detroit Public School Community District called the Saturday Academy. And the Saturday Academy is virtual. We have students who are involved in visual arts, students who are involved in vocal music, who are involved in theater. And the Carr Center has the specific responsibilities of instrumental music and dance. It's a 2-hour program that happens on Saturdays. It's running now until the end of August, I believe.
We've heard so much about our public school teachers having to adjust to digital instruction. It makes me feel, in a funny way, kind of better that no less than Debbie Allen is figuring this out, too.
Oh, yeah. Debbie came on probably, it was early in the pandemic, and she started doing dance classes on Wednesday for the general public on Instagram, and then on Saturdays for young children 4 to 7 years old, there was a dance class that was involved. As I said, we've been doing concerts that we had archived for the past about 2 months or so, 2.5 months, and we've used the platform. We're still learning. The arts are a little bit challenged. There are timing difficulties. Communication. It's important for students to be able to get feedback from the instructors. So we're working through all of those types of things.
You know, the situation in Detroit, as you noted in a recent Facebook post, has been compounded. There is the pandemic that has brought so much grieving to families and extended communities. There is the economic problems that followed the pandemic. And now, as our streets are filled with people getting their voice heard, attention is turning to our other pandemic, racism. And you invited people to support Black artists and multicultural artists by getting involved with the center. Have you had any other conversations about getting the center involved in the movement?
A number of organizations and individuals reached out to us after we did that piece. The conversations are just beginning. The reality is you can't solve a 400-year-old problem in 2 or 3 weeks. But I think that the important thing is that we are currently in a moment, and moments don't last. All of a sudden, the world is all excited about Juneteenth. And I think that we have to be careful about getting excited about those types of things while they're important and they enlighten and they create opportunities. But Juneteenth is one of 365 days in a year. And that's an important thing to look at. I mean, I think that it's also important, and as some of the conversations that I've been involved in speak to, there is a difference between equity and diversity. There's a real challenge from the African-American lens that I look through of what diversity looks like versus the lens that you see diversity in. And how do we get to a point of real equity from an African-American perspective? How can the Carr Center be a part of the long-term solution, not the short-term solution, the long-term solution that can really lead to a changing of the environment, a changing in the way we see each other, perceive each other, work together, and survive? The COVID pandemic raised issues that existed before the COVID pandemic. I think that's really important to know. The digital divide existed last December. It wasn't just found in March. The healthcare disparities existed last October. They didn't happen on March the 17th when my first friend died. You know, those types of things. The challenges that an African-American arts organization has is not something that has happened in just the 30 years that we've existed or the 75 or 80 years that organizations of color and African-American artists have been out there, you know, as organizations doing their things. So there's no quick solution to this, but our organization is committed to diversity through my eyes and equity through my eyes. That's a very different one than what most of the conversation is about.
I just wanted to say I'm terribly sorry to hear about your friend.
Great guy. And, you know, the arts world took big hits. Took big hits. We lost people in Detroit. We lost people in New York. We lost people in New Orleans. You know, we lost people all over the world.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from some of the folks who are longtime friends of the center or staff members, and just where their heads are right now?
Obviously, people who are associated with the center and who have supported the center get it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been there to support it. And so that's been really very positive. I think that the most uplifting thing during the whole initial COVID pandemic, if you will, when we started having staff meetings, there are seven of us. You know, we were having these, we started off with conference calls and then moved to Zoom meetings and you know, just like everybody else. And, you know, we started off hugging each other and lifting each other up. We had one staff member who had a close family member who was in a coma for several weeks, a medically induced in coma, and has successfully come out of it, having a little last minute challenge. So there was a lot of that going on. And so we were holding each other up. But we also had one of our staff members who announced her pregnancy. And, you know, that was a really exciting time for all of us. And that was really exciting to see that glow among all of this. And we went through some tough times while we were waiting to get dollars coming in. People went without pay for a while.
That's hard.
But they met every week and no one ever said a word. And now we're back on track. And then when we came up with the duos, then we decided, let's start with this Rodney project this week. And I've seen the edited footage being put together. And it's really exciting. And I'm just so very, very proud of our people. But I'm grateful to God for giving us the strength to see and to move forward and to get through it. We've always had a platform, but you've given us a voice today that is really wonderful. And it's not just about trying to promote Sunday or trying to promote Debbie Allen. It's about this big picture and this big grand world that we live in. And we got to make it work.
Oliver Ragsdale, we really appreciate all the work that you and everybody at the Carr Center are doing. And thanks for your time just to tell us how things are going right now.
Thanks so much, April. It was great to be with you.
Oliver Ragsdale Jr. is president and CEO of the Carr Center in Detroit. Once again, they do have a Father's Day concert coming up this weekend. You can find the information all over their Facebook page. Coming up, if you feel like there are some holes in your historical knowledge of Black history, you might be forgiven, since public schools have glossed over or avoided huge swaths of American history for decades.
The curriculum, of course, is very much written, and forgive the term, to whitewash some of the more horrific parts of American history.
Maybe it's time for everyone to get reeducated. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan has such an integral place in American history and in Black history. It seems kind of crazy that kids grow up here maybe not knowing about what was going on in Detroit in 1967 or some major figures in the civil rights movement who were from Michigan. As protests against police brutality continue, many activists are pointing out the fact that systemic racism isn't just a problem in policing. It touches every aspect of American society, and that includes education. Today, we wanted to talk a little bit more about how the U.S. educational system reinforces inequalities of a broader world and what a better model for curriculum might look like. Matinga Ragatz is Stateside's education commentator. She is a consultant and a former Michigan Teacher of the Year. Matinga, nice to hear that voice.
Hello.
You're a teacher of long experience. Could you tell us what kind of grade you would give schools when it comes to teaching and talking about race?
Well, first, I want to move away from the grading. I just kind of leave that for like meat quality. So instead, I would like to talk about just basically assessing where we're at right now and assessing the effectiveness of what the education system has done when it comes for race. And I'm going to start with this premise that, you know, racism has the ability to morph and go underground. And so that's basically what we're talking about today. We're talking about this underground racism that is not overt to the practitioners of education. So, you know, I want to really highlight that if we are not talking about race, like schools, we don't talk about race, it's become this fear that we're going to separate people by talking about race, by talking about economic levels and things like that. But what has happened is by not talking directly about race, we have reduced ourselves to talking and using dog whistles and coded language to talk about race. Does that make sense?
Letting other people frame the conversation instead of having it in our schools?
Yes, for sure. And then, you know, teachers use terms like free and reduced lunch to describe a certain population of kids versus terms like, you know, maybe like farm rural American schools or terms mm-hmm. like the heartland of America. And then you just tell me what races you associate with each term.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans of your generation and mine probably had a pretty limited exposure to Black history while we were in school. Would you say that that's changed?
It has. It has to an extent. But you got to remember that the majority of U.S. teachers are white, and the majority of the teachers of color, of course, are teaching in the schools with greater diversity, which means white schools have white teachers. And white communities are systematically segregated. We all know this. And so an educator that's been teaching 30 years in a community can be completely removed from the Black experience. So, you know, they are teaching, mind you, from their own vantage point and from their lived experiences. In the 21st century, that's just, you know, that's something that we need to change. Where teachers, it's not about book knowledge anymore. It's really about experiential knowledge. So when a teacher is talking about racism, they can only teach according to the relations that they have, maybe, you know, cordial relations I'm talking about that they have with people of color that they occasionally may meet and they're not necessarily part of their intimate circle. So I'm not throwing blame here. I'm just explaining that teachers of like white teachers are teaching from their experiences and not because they want to somehow be an obstacle to race.
Right. Does Michigan have anything like state curriculum guidelines or straight up rules about what kids need to know about Black history?
Well, yeah, we have our curriculum, and the curriculum, of course, is very much written to, and forgive the term, to whitewash some of the more horrific parts of American history. You know, so this is where I think sometimes the curriculum, and again, we are thinking about kids as, you know, we cannot expose the kids to this because they're too sensitive. But what we are doing is becoming part of the problem, because you will see that racism turns its ugly head in the curriculum when you constantly depict people of color as victims and you're only telling the story of their struggle, but you do not specifically tell the story about how they began their struggle. So when you're specifically talking about, for example, slavery, right, you don't talk about slavery in terms of like human trafficking and rape and murder and complete and absolute devastation of somebody's heritage and uprooting somebody's culture that took thousands of years to build. And now 500 years later, they're still trying to build it. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, combine that with the rather grand narratives that we get of white America, the almost godlike status of the founding fathers. And it gets to be a pretty messed up, a pretty disjointed picture for school kids to take in. If we did say we want people to hear more about the continuity of Black culture, we want them to hear about things like the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, or we want them to hear about Juneteenth as being more of an Independence Day than July 4th Independence Day in a lot of ways. What would it look like to shift the curriculum, especially with this understanding that you're talking about, that a lot of Michigan's teachers are white?
Well, there's got to be a concerted effort, because you got to understand the power of whitewashing a curriculum. You know, we have to make sure that we teach the children the workings of the politics of race and how a dominant culture is structured to create this hierarchy of human value, right? And so what I'm trying to say is there's a clear demarcation that some people are simply more valuable than other people, especially when it comes to race. And there are people who believe to this day that when people of color begin to populate their schools and their suburbs, it devalues their property and it devalues the quality of their school. And so I want to ask the question, you know, what exactly are you saying by that? And if you are believing that, or at least living in that environment, what are you not teaching?
Yeah.
These kids, so that they can in the future propagate this problem.
Matinga, you worked in a mostly white suburban school district for a pretty long time as a Black woman. How did you talk to your students about race?
Well, I just put it out there. I spend a lot of time recreating my curriculum to the, you know, consternation of my administrators to make sure that we're talking about race, about colorism, and about culture. I turned a small, like a minimal geography class into a global studies class specifically to intentionally talk about, quote, the others. And so for me, it was very easy. Students of color in my school you know, were drawn to my classroom because that was a safe space. That was a place where we could take off the superhero cape, mind you. And so for me, it was a no-brainer to make sure that the kids that I saw myself in those kids, and I wanted to make sure that they felt like their histories and their heritage also had contributions to this great country.
Were you often in a position of talking to your colleagues about how they were teaching?
No. That's something that I regret I never was doing. I never did that. I tried my best to assimilate because that furthered my interests and my agenda of culturally responsive teaching. And I felt in my experience that being confrontational was not going to get me what I wanted. But you should also know that I also had some amazing colleagues that were allies to what I was trying to do, and they supported what I did.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like if you're the only person of color, it seems like anyone being the only person of color in a mostly white school staff, that there is an expectation of an awful lot of extra work in educating not just students but other colleagues about aspects of this. That's I think we'll classify that under uncompensated other tasks.
No,
as
it's that black teacher stressor. But, you know, again, it wasn't outward teaching. It was, I think, the stress became the constant having to be much better. So I always felt like I have to be a lot more knowledgeable, a lot more prepared than my counterparts in order to be at the same level. And it's the constant feeling like you are the ambassador of all things black, and you don't want people to judge black people by your actions. And it's something that I don't think white people think about when they go to it. They don't think, oh, well, somebody here is going to judge me because I'm white, unless you are outside of your environment.
The superintendent of the school district where you worked recently resigned after making comments about George Floyd, basically saying that Mr. Floyd would not have been in a position to have an encounter with the police if he had not tried to use a counterfeit bill, if he had not resisted the officers. Questions, and there were all these questions suddenly out there about how people at the top of the ladder in school systems can be brought into this moment that America is having with a new paradigm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. You know, this was a really unfortunate incident, and I think that this speaks to his experience as a law-abiding white American. He does not speak from the experience of the law-abiding black children and the law-abiding black men within his own school in terms of arrests, the law, and judicial systems. You know, it makes it perfectly obvious that it's not enough for districts to just take away the jobs of these type of leaders. Leaders who lack empathy and I think lack cultural literacy, they will just simply be replaced by like-minded people, right? So I believe that it is not enough to simply write a statement of regret to the community. Districts like this, I mean, like if you Google this district right now, this is the highlight of their community. So this district, the school district needs to present their community with a 5-year plan that ensures that more racial inclusion, more cultural sensitivity training for their board members, the administrators, their teachers, their students, and to really ensure that the curriculum is inclusive. And I have a list of things, but I'm going to just kind of nip it off and say that, you know, they just need to have a much more responsive attitude towards the racial concerns of their students of color. Because your school system is a brand for your community.
Yeah. Are there other things that come to mind when you think about what systemic racism looks like within education systems?
For sure. You know, and for teachers, it's really, really hard to look at the statistics of race relations in the schools and how discriminatory some of our well-meaning actions are. There is this narrative that racism is an outward and sometimes a violent demonstration of power. But, you know, racism in America, again, it can be a lot more nuanced. And so study after study, we'll talk about, of course, we've heard about the kids of color. They're more likely to be suspended. They're more likely to be expelled or turned over to the police. And we specifically know about studies where middle school Black girls, especially, you know, from age 12, they are just seen to be less innocent, and they expected to be stronger, so that their emotions are recognized. The only emotions that are recognized in them is anger, because anger, you can get with anger the same thing that their white counterpart gets with tears. And so in education, we need to be very self-conscious of the narrative that we're giving the students as to the path to success. Because a white teacher teaching the student about this onboarding ramp into the economic system is not necessarily aware of the gaps and the crevices that these students of color have to overcome in order to get to the same place. We need to, you know, I really believe that if we indeed believe that education is economic development, we have to address the issue of race before we even address the issue of economic equality.
There are incidents in American history that can really inform how we think about the exercise of power against Black Americans, things like the Tulsa Massacre. Why aren't events like that covered more thoroughly, or even covered at all, in curriculum today?
April, simply put, it is a conflict to this narrative that Black people are scary, brutal, and uncivilized. So it's just not politically and not socially acceptable to learn that Black people, when left alone, can live like white people and to the betterment of the society as a whole. So by reducing the history of Indigenous and Black people in America to teepees, ghettos, you know, you preserve this idea that they're not real Americans. They are not like us. They are hyphenated Americans. I'm American, but you're an African American. You're an Indigenous American. You're a Native American. And so those types of narratives are so important politically, I think, to preserve, that we have lost track of the plot, and we are not including those in the curriculum. That's why it's so important to talk about race and talk about race openly in schools today.
You know, this week even, this is Juneteenth, which for a lot of Black communities, it was sort of some kind of turning point. And yet it's not even, I think there are some reads of American history that aren't even aware of it. Are there things that you wish were more commonly highlighted about the, just something as simple as the spread of knowledge across the country?
Definitely. I mean, the events that we've witnessed in the past 3 weeks in our country are in the world, right? Just highlight this gap. And, you know, events like Juneteenth have been important to the Black community, especially in the South. And I think this year people should just observe that, and not necessarily observe it in your own home. I mean, like, you know, go on the internet and see how that is celebrated. Maybe you could want to have your own barbecue at your own house in celebration of Juneteenth. But the more you know, the more empathetic you can become. In April, you know, I want to make sure that you know that teachers will be doing a lot of soul searching this summer. It's been a tough and brutal year. And between CDC guidelines for opening schools, between teaching during the pandemic, and now really turning everything upside down in a sense that, you know, a lot of teachers have had these revelations about the way that they were delivering their content. It is very, very difficult. And I want to just, first of all, congratulate teachers who are trying their best to do some equity work. The work that the teachers will do this summer is unpaid work, because you don't get paid until, you know, September. And if there's any lawmakers, is there any Department of Education listeners out there, I want to encourage them to give us one more year without that test, so that we can land. It just kind of soften our landing. And I want to really ask administrators out there, how will your community evolve because of the events of 2020? And, you know, how will you teach, and how will the learning be different? What lessons will you teach your students because of the past 4 months?
Education consultant Matenga Ragatz is a former Michigan Teacher of the Year. Matenga, it's great to talk to you, as always.
Thank you, April.
That's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and April Van Buren, with help from our interns, Leah Beldori, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Bear. You have a safe weekend. We'll catch you on Monday.